been part of a political protest. It was that was a scary prospect watching what happened at the WTO. It's like, well, that's actual, you know, there's danger there. How dangerous is it to express dissent, something that is one of our basic rights? And from that, I'd like to sort of just move on. What I wanted to talk about that related, you know, to the predictive policing, that one story evoked so many connected ideas for me. And one of the ideas I was really curious to hear from you is about Chinese social credit and facial recognition, what's going on there, because that is a worst case scenario. I mean, that's beyond Orwellian, or it's, I mean, it's right there. And many Chinese go along with it. They see it, oh, I can get, you know, they're thinking of it from a very personal, self-centered point of view. Oh, I can get things by just acting normal because I don't do anything wrong. But it also, you know, there's this unbelievable tracking, the number of facial recognition cameras tracking where you're going. And it brought me to the Minority Report, you know, where people are tracked based on iris scanning. And if you don't want to be tracked, you can go get some other eyeballs and kind of carry them around or have them, you know, put in to, you know, disguise who you are. And I know that sounds really science fictiony, but I'm not sure it's that science fictiony anymore.
Well, certainly people have had artificial fingerprints.
Right. So when we have the social credit that includes you're tracking you everywhere you're going and what you're doing and what you're buying and if you're being good and did your neighbor, you know, did you make your neighbor angry? So now your neighbor is accusing you of something that's going to lower your social credit, which currently in China can prevent you from traveling. It can prevent you from buying certain things.
Borrowing money,
Yeah, borrowing money.
getting access to employment, and so on.
Right. So tell me where what you're thinking about those things.
I think that there is a kind of optimization curve that sits between guard labor and inequality. That when you have systems that are really unequal, eventually people start building guillotines. And it's expensive to stop people from building guillotines. You need cops, and you need guards, and you need fences, and you need spies, and all of this other stuff. And there is a point at which it is cheaper to redistribute some of the wealth you've hoarded than it is to hire the cops to protect it, right? And to diffuse that. And that the history of technology over the last 40 years has been a lessening of the overall cost of guard labor with the effect that you can have stable inequalities that are much more unequal. And China is one of those places, right? China, for all that it has also lifted a huge number of people out of poverty, it's done so through systems that have made a small number of people unimaginably rich with a very unstable footing, right? That there are so many credit bubbles in China that are on the verge of bursting. People, you know, the one-child policy has led to a demographic crisis where you have a massive shortage of working-age people and a large number of pensioners. And you know, the Confucianism dictates that you should be just taking care of your parents instead of having a state pension for them, and that's the system that we set up. But then you have a couple
When
with,
you're working full time with two
yeah.
people, you can't take care of your
Four
family.
living parents, you
Right.
know, eight living grandparents, and a kid with one working age couple
Right.
supporting them, right? And so I think that a lot of what's going on in China, you can think of as a way to deploy high-tech guard labor to stabilize a system rather than creating egalitarian or pluralistic systems that benefit everyone. And that one of the reasons people go along with it is China's weak institutions and its bubbles and its problems. And you know, structural problems has created a sense of precarity and anxiety in people, right? That you know, one of the problems that China really has is debt defaulting, because you can't survive. It's a credit economy like here. You can't survive without borrowing money. But the terms on which people borrow money, especially through the shadow banking industry, you know, so there's the pawn shop industry, which actually is not pawn. It's not guitars there. Pawn shops there mostly take real estate in credit,
Oh.
or interest in business as credit, and they plug cash flow holes in these small manufacturing businesses and so on, with these massive black market credit bubbles. You have these huge problems with defaults. You have problems with people walking out on their social obligations, whether that's their families, their parents, or whatever. And you have grifter firms that just do a bunk and don't make payroll, right? And leave everyone out. And so people are hungry to see those behaviors punished, because if you're not defaulting and you're enduring great hardship in order to do it, seeing someone else do it, and moreover, being expected to pick up the slack when someone else does it, it's really infuriating, enraging, and it fuels this anxiety and this sense of precarity, because part of the story that's going on in the back of your mind when you see that happening is, will that be me someday, right? And so everyone wants to discipline their neighbors and force their neighbors into this brittle, fragile system, because they understand how brittle and fragile it is. They understand that there's only so much defaults the system can tolerate before it starts to collapse. And people are worried about it, right? They have this sense that you know, they have a cultural memory of the Cultural Revolution and other great collapses, the famine. And they don't want to go back there, right? They value the stability of it. And so having accumulated all of this debt, not just financial debt, but environmental debt, policy debt, demographic debt, I think that this authoritarianism has found, this high-tech authoritarianism has found a welcome home, only because it works well, but not because it fails well. I think it fails really badly. As you say, it's really easy to use corruption, to use this to supercharge corruption, right? To rat out your neighbor, to do things that where you can punish the people around you for small slights, right? You can supercharge your corruption. And when that starts to happen, right, when it becomes part of the sort of Stasi-style snitch economy, right, then you'll have people who really regret it, and it might be too late by then.
Interesting. Well, I have one more question for you.
Sure, of course.
I'm talking with Cory Doctorow today, author of his most recent book is Radicalized, and you're going to be speaking in Seattle tomorrow, although when this airs in April, that will already have passed. But
right.
Chris, this book is available. I imagine it's available at Powell's.
Yeah, it's at Powell's. In fact, my next stop after this is to go sign some copies there.
Oh, fine.
I've left a litter of signed copies across America. So
my last question to you is, when and how and what was it that radicalized you?
Well, I was raised by radical parents. My parents are Trotskyists. And my mom was a women's rights and reproductive rights organizer. The story goes that when I was 5, they told me that I was going to march at my aunt's wedding and asked me if I knew how to march. And I apparently started walking back and forth chanting, "Not the church and not the state, women must control their fate." I was an anti-nuclear proliferation activist in the 80s as a tween and as a teen. This was obviously the Reagan years, very precarious, but also Canada was the NATO testing ground. That's where the uranium for the American missile program came from. And, you know, there was this, we didn't know it, right? But we were at the dawn of the neoliberal era, right? We thought that history was in cycles, that you had conservative times and radical times or liberal times. And we didn't quite understand that most of human history was oligarchic, that you have a few of, you know, bonfires that destroy so much capital that the grip of the wealthy is weakened temporarily. And you have these progressive moments, you know, the two world wars being the most recent one. And that after that, barring some cataclysm that destroys a lot of capital, the rich will eventually accumulate so much capital that they start to call the policy shots. And then you enter a new oligarchic or semi-feudal era. And right now, I'm very anxious because I think that the obvious next cataclysmic event that weakens the grip of the rich and allows us to make policy that is pluralistic and evidence-based instead of parochial and in the service of the 1% is an environmental collapse.
I knew that's what you were going to say.
And rebuilding out of an environmental collapse, that's a hard task. You can see this being written about very beautifully in Kim Stanley Robinson's New York 2140, which is, you know, really about building up out of the ashes and about the reassertion of capital after a period that, for all of its horrors after these cataclysmic events, is also a time of great excitement, in the same way that the post-war years were a time of great excitement and a time of incredible possibility.
you know, my mouth is often hanging open. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm like looking at a headline and being like, oh my God.
I feel like, so science fiction writers suck at predicting the future. No one can predict the future. Science fiction writers are particularly bad at it. But there are some things that you can be relatively confident about,
yeah,
right?
Frank like Herbert.
Yeah. But, you know, if there's like, if a million people are born this year, then in 18 years, there will not be more than a million 18-year-olds. Right? I mean, those are just facts, right? We know about what's going to happen with carbon, right? We have a relatively high degree of confidence about what's going to happen with the climate. What we don't know is what we're going to do about it, how we will live with it, whether we will find solidarity, fellow feeling, and a wake-up call for evidence-based policy, or whether it will be barbarism and neighbor on neighbor. And these are, the reason we don't know that is because it depends on what we choose. Right. It's a future of our making, and it's our future to make. And it's very hard to know in the moment whether the reason your adversary seems unassailable is because they're at the peak of their power, or because their power is so fragile that they lash out at anything that threatens it. You know, in the run-up to the Russian Revolution, there were a lot of tacticians who said that they favored overturning the Tsar, but given the Tsar's complete and total put-downs of all the peasant rebellions that had led up to it, this would be the wrong time because the Tsar was clearly at the peak of his power. And they were wrong, right? The Tsar was actually about to topple. In the same way, the so-called leaders of the revolution started to get offered concessions by the Tsar. You know, at one point he said, well, you can have an advisory parliament, a Duma, and you can sit and come up with policies, and you can tell me what they are. I won't promise I'll do anything about them. Okay. And they were like, well, that's probably as far as we're going to get now. We, you know, this is a game of inches. And the Duma would sit to meet. And the so-called followers would march into the Duma and shout, all power to the people, all power to the Soviet. Basically, what the hell are you people doing? Get out there and seize power, right? This is not, you know, we are not making concessions.
Because no
one
gives it away.
Yeah, because no one gives it away. You know, if he offers you an inch, you take a mile. And we are at a moment now where our activist job has changed from we need to convince politicians to front policies that we're willing to vote for.
And we need different politicians.
Well, now we're at a point where we need to convince people to vote for policies that our politicians have put forward. You know, Elizabeth Warren, hardly a day goes by that Elizabeth Warren doesn't drop a killer bomb on the Washington consensus. Today it was a farm bill that breaks up Monsanto and breaks up Dow and has a right to repair component and breaks up Purdue, the chicken people, not the pharma people, and, you know, has a whole raft of super progressive policies that are widely supported in the country by everyone except for a small clutch of politicians and the lobbyists they serve. I can't remember the last time I had a policy I wanted to vote for as much as this one. So we are in quite a turning point, and there's reason for hope.
Cory Doctorow, thank you. Thank you so much
for
joining us on the Digital Divide today. It's such a pleasure to talk with you in person.
My pleasure, too.
And you can get his book, Radicalized, online, in person, just about anywhere.
Sure, yep.
And check it out. It's four novellas, each one a compelling read about a future we may have or that we might be living right
sure.
now.
And I should mention there's also a DRM-free audiobook. Will Wheaton is one of the readers. It's a terrific audiobook. And also The Intercept's TV arm is making a TV show out of Unauthorized Bread.
Very cool. Well, congratulations
thank
on
you.
That. Cory Doctorow, thank you.
Wow. There's a raise your hand, stand up, count yourself in, make a difference kind of deal, right? And we are asking you to do that at kboo.fm or 877-500-5266. Help us bring this kind of conversation to your ears. I was just listening to that and I am like, wow. Amazing. This is what we need more of today. So, yeah, right? So, 877-500-5266. We have, as a gift for a $10 a month donation, that's $120 a year. And listening to Cory here, I'm going to get one of these myself. So we have two book packs. Pack one is Robert Scheer, Cory Doctorow, who we were just listening to, and John Chaney Lippold. The second pack is William Richards, Pedro Domingos, and Cory Doctorow again. So either way, you get Cory. You got to love it.
And you know, Gwen, the wonderful thing about this is not only can listeners get one of these two terrific book packs and you know, packed, no pun intended, with information, but by doing so, they're actually doubling their membership value because we are still in the middle of that $1,500 matching period with from the anonymous donor who we are thanking so much. And we're thanking you, our listeners, for also participating in this very important spring membership drive. 70% of our revenue comes from you, the members, and we need you to pick up the phone and show your continued support for your community radio station by calling 877-500-5266. Again, that number is 877-500-5266, or you can do it online. If you're at your computer right now, you can just kind of go to the internet, go to kboo.fm. Our lovely green page will pop up, and at the top right corner, you'll see that button marked Donate. But whichever way you choose to do it, this is a good opportunity for you to show your ongoing commitment to your community radio station here on our News and Public Affairs Day. And not only can you pick up one of these tremendous thank you gifts for your donation of $10 or more, but you'll also have the opportunity to see your membership dollar doubled. And, you know, what can be better than that? So again, 877-500-5266 or online at kboo.fm.
Or the handy dandy app right on your phone. Very easy. All of these donations that we appreciate so much are brought, you know, sorry, allows us to continue bringing you.
I know it's been a long drive already, hasn't
it?
Let
me tie that up a little bit more for you. You know, here again, you know, we are volunteers. We are people just like yourselves listening. And we are asking you to give us a call, make that donation. We're asking for $10 or more right now. 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-5266 or online at kboo.fm.
You know, Gwen, I think one of the things that is probably worth reminding the listeners, and probably many of them know, but not all, is that one of the prime missions here at KBOO is to train future radio journalists, programmers, cultural affairs. And in fact, I'm looking into the next studio and I can see an intro to audio training course going on. So, you know, your dollars go to more than just putting our voices in your ear. Your dollars go to support the training facilities here, the community outreach we're involved in. Your dollars go to support the live remotes that we do, such as Good in the Hood and the Waterfront Blues and so on. So think about that. This is a good time to show your support. Give us a call, 877-500-5266. We're suggesting $10 a month to pick up one of those book packages, or your $10 a month could get you part of the one of the wonderful pieces of KBOO apparel. When you give a call, one of our volunteers will be able to walk you through the thank you gifts. We'd be only too happy to give to you in thanks for your showing your support for your community radio station. So please give us a call. 877-500-5266 during this very important matching period. We have an opportunity from a generous benefactor, an anonymous one who's willing to match up to $1,500 today. So please take this opportunity, pick up that phone, give us a call, 877-500-5266. And Gwen, I think we're just about ready to go back to Radio Zine.
I'm ready to hear more of that.
Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Cory Doctorow, whose latest book is titled Homeland. It's a sequel to Little Brother. These are being marketed as young adult novels. Cory Doctorow has a long and pretty distinguished history in science fiction and in the world of computers and free speech, contributor to magazines and websites, ongoing at boingboing.net, co-founded Open Source Open Cola, and has dealt with several other issues, which we will talk about. Cory Doctorow, Homeland is also the name of a Showtime TV series. Why did you choose to either keep the name, create the name, not change the name?
Originally, Little Brother went through a period where it was called Homeland in manuscript because the marketing department wasn't sure whether young people would have heard of Orwell, and they thought that they might associate it with the TV show Big Brother. And I always liked the name Homeland. And I live in the United Kingdom where I don't think we have that TV show. I don't watch a lot of TV, but I'm pretty sure we don't have that TV show. So it wasn't really on my radar. But I'm also pretty sanguine about title duplication. I mean, you know, I write in the world of science fiction where there have been several celebrated novels called Nightfall. And, you know, I've deliberately played with that with a series of stories that have the same titles as famous stories. I was up for the Hugo Award for a story called I, Robot, and then again for a story called True Names. I've written stories with titles like Enda's Game, and I'm now working on a story for a Neal Stephenson Arizona State University project called The Man Who Sold the Moon. So using other people's titles is something I've been at for a long time.
The main character, Marcus, now I don't know how deliberate that was. On some level, was Marcus Aaron Swartz?
I don't think so. I mean, lots of people have asked me that. And obviously, Aaron is an old friend of mine. I knew him from the age of about 14. And he was a very clever kid. But he wasn't like Marcus. You know, he was like Marcus in that he was technologically skilled, but their personalities were not, had lots of ways in which they were different. And then the other thing people ask is, well, is this meant to be you as a kid? And I was never that cool either. It may be aspirational, but it's certainly not biographical. You know, he's a construct of lots of bright young people I knew and know. He has his own problems, and some of them are familiar to people who followed Aaron's stories, but some of them are just his own.
Both Little Brother and Homeland are young adult novels. There's characterization, you follow the plot. But it seems to me in reading the books that there's more to it than that, that there's something else that you're doing. Can you talk about that?
I think on the one hand, they are intended as artworks. But they're also intended to instruct, but not instruct through kind of recipes or through recitals of fact, but rather we've passed the era where you need a book like Steal This Book or the Whole Earth Catalog to tell you what's out there. Everything that you could possibly want to know how to do is one query away. What you need to know is what to query, right? What you need to know is what's possible. And so what I feel like is that if you write a novel in which people do and live in a way that is inspiring, and you make it clear that the stuff that's in this book is stuff that also does or could exist in the real world, that you then give young people the one step that they're missing to actually make it a reality for themselves, which is the knowledge that it's possible so they can go and search for it. The time frame for Homeland and Little Brother is like a contrafactual near future that is deliberately vague, deliberately indeterminate, and I try to play with that by ensuring that there's always mostly possible things, lots of real things, some things that aren't real but are possible, and some things that are probably impossible given our current state of the art, as a way of kind of, I think, heightening the sense that this is a near now, but not meant to be literally parsed out from now. There's no set of steps that takes you from here to there, so that you also can't say, well, wait, we skipped one of those steps you predicted, therefore this is no longer an accurate prediction of the future. I think science fiction sucks as a predictive literature anyway. You know?
Well, yeah.
science fiction's reputation as a predictive literature is like, it's like firing a shotgun into the side of a barn and then drawing a target around the space where all the pellets have hit. You know, we've had so many science fiction predictions and so few of them have come true, and yet we cite those as science fiction's great predictive strength. What science fiction, I think, is really great at is inspiring the future. You know, Gene Roddenberry didn't predict the Motorola flip phone, but Gene Roddenberry inspired those engineers to make the Motorola flip phone with the Star Trek communicators. You know, to the extent that I'm trying to do something with the future here, that's what I'm trying to do.
Cory Doctorow, toward the end of the book, there's a demonstration, and in order to stop the demonstration, police use a gun, some kind of electronic device, to cut off all electronics in the immediate area. Does that exist?
The Hurf guns, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Herf guns are real for sure. I mean, you know, as long ago as like 10 years ago, there was a kid who won a science fair prize for a $200 Herf gun that was a car battery and an old pizza dish, satellite dish that he could use to reboot a laptop at 100 feet. So herfing electronics is definitely real. Whether or not the police are currently planning, or the military are planning, like sort of adversarial weaponized herf devices, I don't think so. But there's no reason to say they couldn't. I think that it's way more likely than the police say killing cars that they're chasing with herf guns is more likely that you'll get things like telemetry systems in cars that have a lawful interception requirement, like the one that we have in phone switches now, where anyone who builds a phone switch has to build in a facility to allow for police wiretaps to be initiated remotely. So the police don't have to go down to the central office of the phone company. They just log into a computer, type it, and they can start wiretapping a phone. That lawful interception is a increasing trend in lots of different realms of hardware. And I think it's way more likely that you'd have like an outgrowth of something like the GPS or sat nav that's already built into your dashboard, having some kind of lawful interception backdoor where the police could remotely cause your engine to stall out or, you know, switch you into a low gear or whatever.
You have been listening to Radio Zine's interview with, you've been listening to Radio Zine's interview with Cory Doctorow here on KBOO during our News and Public Affairs Day. Please stay tuned for more programming. But first, pick up the phone and give us a call and become a member. Go to 877-500-5266. Again, that number is 877-500-5266 to become a member and show your support for your community radio station. Coming up next, Ken Jones interviews Roger McNamee, author of the new book, Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe.
KBOO would like to give special thanks to our local community partners who've donated food for our volunteers today. Breakfast was provided by Gravy, with locations in Boise at 3957 North Mississippi Avenue and in Kearns at 3101 Northeast Sandy Boulevard. Serving traditional American breakfast and brunch, both locations are open daily from 7:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. Lunch was provided by Atlas Pizza, located at 3570 Southeast Division Street, open 11:30 a.m. to 11 p.m. or later every day. More information at atlaspizzapdx.com. Dinner was provided by Di Nicola's, located in the Creston Kenilworth neighborhood at 3520 Southeast Powell Boulevard. Di Nicola's authentic Italian restaurant has been a family-run Portland institution for over 40 years, serving classic Italian cuisine and pizza, open daily from 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. or later. For more information on how you can support KBOO, call 877-500-5266 right now.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the world premiere of Jump, co-produced by Confrontation Theater and the Milagro Theater. The play runs from March 21st through April 13th at the Milagro Theater in Portland. Jump is the story of a 20-something who is reeling from the death of her mother. She is looking for solace in a good place to vape, but what she finds is a journey of self-discovery. Again, that's Jump, every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday from March 21st through April 13th at the Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Still coming up on KBOO's News and Public Affairs Day, next, Ken Jones interviews Roger McNamee, author of the book Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe. At 2 p.m., it's challenging the both sides narrative, difference between fascist and Antifa movements in the Trump era with Dr. Stanislav Vistosky. At 3, it's a special News and Public Affairs Day airing of Alternative Radio, featuring a talk about Shoshana Zuboff, author of The Age of the Surveillance Capitalism. At 4, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. And at 5, it's your KBOO Evening News. All of this program is made possible by member support, and we're asking you to take this opportunity, like Jordy in North Portland, who is a new member, take this opportunity to give us a call and become a member and support your community radio station. Call 877 500 5266 or go online to KBOU.